welcome once again to EWTN's Bookmark. Our guest author is Anthony E. Clark, PhD. His book, Catholicism and Buddhism, The Contrasting Lives and Teachings of Jesus and Buddha, published by Cascade Books, available through the EWTN Religious Catalog, EWTNRC.com, all things Catholic. Pleasure to see you again.
Good to see you.
You did a mini-series for us.
I did.
A while back, and we did a book, and you were obviously on with Father Mitch, kind of talking about this same topic. So I know you had a connection with China.
Right.
Okay, because of the series that you did for us. Is that how you got interested in Buddhism, or explain?
Right. So my first book wasn't about Christianity at all, but when I was working on it in China, I encountered the stories of Catholic martyrs who died in China. And as a Catholic, it was so moving to me that I actually just shifted my entire career towards studying the church in China. And I've been working on martyrdom in China now for a couple decades. And what's interesting about that is the Catholic community is growing exponentially, and especially the Protestant community. And Buddhism isn't really growing that quickly. But you do find this kind
of... You're talking about in China,
in China itself now? Right now, in China.
That's also why the state's worried, isn't it?
Oh, the state's very worried. Of course it is. I mean, it's worried about the growth of any religion.
Right.
But I mean, the question of suffering and the question of life, if you're in China, there are really three places. Communism, which isn't very helpful. Buddhism or Christianity. And this interest in Buddhism emerged largely from living in China, encountering Buddhists, and really interrogating what's the difference between, you know, trying to find a way to deal with
life. Well, that's how your interest came. Why do you think there's so much interest in the West for Buddhism, especially these days?
Right. Interestingly, I think we live in a post-World War I, World War II era, wherein there was this reaction against religion, largely against Christianity. And you start to see in the 1950s, you know, with Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg.
Yeah, you brought him up. I didn't realize he was a Buddhist.
Right? This so-called beatnik generation.
Yeah, I never connected the beatniks with Buddhism either until I read your book.
If you read Dharma Bums, you see the Buddha appearing. And Kerouac's poetry loves to talk about the Buddha. And he considered himself a Buddhist. And so from that era in the 1950s, you just start to see this huge growth of Buddhism. And I hear this all the time. Buddhism is the, quote, safe religion. Buddhism is the religion that is, quote, peaceful. It's the alternative to, you know, this outdated Christianity that people view as being responsible for the wars or responsible for the Crusades.
Is it also helpful because there's not a lot of rules?
Well, you know, there are rules in Buddhism. The thing is, there are not rules in American Buddhism.
Well, that's the thing. You talk about buffet Buddhism like a cafeteria Catholicism, right?
So,
or at least Carl Olson does.
Right. So you have, I mean, Carl, that's a great turn of phrase that Carl uses. Yeah. No, I mean, a buffet Buddhism is a real thing.
Right.
And I think in America especially, you can go to any, you know, you can go to any household store and you'll find statues of the Buddha, but you won't find a crucifix or a statue of Our Lady. You might find Francis, but you'll find statues of Buddha. And that is an interesting question.
Put in your garden or whatever. Right.
And the big question is, what is American Buddhism? It's not quite like Buddhism in the rest of the world.
It's really, like you said, this Zen idea of what they talk about. You know, Zen masters, you hear about it with the Society of Jesus and these things out there. But it is like they pick and choose the things that they like. And what is it that they like about it, do you think?
From my point of view, the thing that people typically like about Buddhism and Zen, Zen's become this catchphrase. Actually, Zen is a very small portion of Buddhists.
Is it really?
Okay. It's a very small portion of Buddhists, and it's a Japanese form of Buddhism, and it's the minority group of Buddhists in Japan.
But why do we hear about it all the time?
Well, because it's become, you know, Zen and the art of motorcycle mechanics.
Okay,
Zen
just the way people...
So Zen has gained currency, and the beatniks used to love to talk about Zen.
Okay.
And Zen is a very iconoclastic form of Buddhism. So Zen Buddhism, for example, denies the utility of Buddhist sutras. It might study them, but it says that basically Zen Buddhism says kill the Buddha. So it becomes a kind of iconoclastic form of Buddhism, and a lot of Americans in the 1950s, 1960s, really into iconoclasm.
Because they're basically rebelling against society and norms and stuff.
Right, and I also think that for many people, Buddhism is a pluralistic alternative to having a creedal devotion to one particular religious identity.
Well, you talk about in the beginning, and now you and Carl Olson wrote an article, right? Is that
we
what
did.
It was? And
yeah.
That's kind of the premise or the germ for this particular
the
book?
The germ for this book was an article that I wrote with Carl Olson that was... Goodness, it used to be called This Rock, became
right, the
Catholic
old,
Answers.
Catholic yeah. Answers magazine. Right.
And we wrote an article, got an enormous amount of response.
I'm sure I read that.
We were here chatting with Father Mitch Pacwa, who said in the back room, I think just after makeup, said, y'all should write a book about Catholicism and Buddhism.
Right.
And that...
Yeah, because Mitch had done some stuff on New Age and
oh,
stuff
Oh, goodness,
like
a
that.
Lot, right, yeah. Right. So that really inspired this project.
Now, in the beginning here, the foreword Carl wrote, he talks about the idea that about 1% of Americans identify as Buddhism. You know, Hawaii is like 4%, California 2%, Delaware. Buddhism has fewer adherents in the 50 states than Islam, than Mormonism, than the Watchtower Society, Jehovah's Witnesses, or Eastern Orthodoxy. Yet it appears in many ways to have a more substantial cultural footprint.
This is interesting.
As you were indicating.
Right.
Why?
Again, I hear often that Buddhism is the quote-unquote safe religion. Mm-hmm. And it's also, I think, largely accepted. If you go to someone's home in our very secular country,
right, right.
If they have a statue of the Buddha, people are not really that offended. But mm-hmm. I've had people come into my home with a Sacred Heart image and ask that we can move into another room.
Really?
So there is this idea that...
Well, that's because the Sacred Heart actually represents something that's real.
Well, it represents it. It absolutely represents something that's real.
That's why they're bothered by it, I think,
right,
whether they realize
right.
it or not.
And the interesting thing is here's the
Buddha
most,
doesn't really matter very much.
Well, here's the most merciful image. I mean, God's right. mercy for humanity.
Right.
And then this statue of Buddha represents something very different. But it's an impression. It's a general impression.
You talk about it here. He said, we noted that Buddhism attracts Westerners, including more than a few Christians, because so many in the West desire spiritual vitality in the midst of the emptiness of secular life, long for inner peace in a world bursting with chaos and conflict. Buddhism has an apparently non-dogmatic, open-minded character. It attracts those eager to move beyond what they view as the rigid rules, obviously, and pick and choose. And here's a phrase that popped up, and I know there's been a lot of tumult about, the idea of mindfulness,
oh, right.
which I didn't realize, I guess, was central to Buddhism.
Right, yeah.
Because we hear about that a lot. In the...
Yeah, quite a lot.
In Christian, Catholic, and in just the secular mm-hmm. culture.
So in Buddhism, the first thing I should say that's very important as to be a Buddhist is not to have a Buddhist statue in your home mm-hmm. and sort of identify as a Buddhist. To be formally a Buddhist, you take vows. And those vows are what we call the three jewels. I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, and I take refuge in the Buddhist community, the Sangha. So, I mean, even the Dalai Lama, when he sees all these Americans are referring to themselves as Buddhists, the Dalai Lama says, I don't really get this. It's like putting a yak's head on a sheep's body. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Dalai Lama is very honest about this. They're not the same thing. So
almost all other religions are. We're the ones who seem to always have the worry about offending people.
Right,
when we state what's true.
We are, and you know, I am a third order Dominican. Our you know motto is Veritas. Mm-hmm. So this commitment to truth is one of the things I love about Ratzinger's work. But mindfulness is mm-hmm. part of this Buddhist practice called Bhavana, which is, I mean, there are all these techniques to attain Nirvana, which I think people. They assume that it's this 90s grunge band in Seattle, and Nirvana is something completely different than what people assume. But mindfulness is a technique mm-hmm. for viewing reality in a way that removes you from reality. You're supposed to be mindful and see things so that you realize that everything is passing, and therefore there's no impermanence, and therefore there's no
right.
there's no I, there's no ego, there's no self. Now, this is very different than what people think it is. Mm-hmm. And the idea is to achieve
right.
a kind of awakening.
Well, you say, however, it's my aim to help Christians become better aware that Buddhism and Christianity are not the same. Also, I guess the question, are they compatible, at least in the way some people have tried to, in the church even, make it compatible?
There are two major traps, I think, mm-hmm. with people who think about Buddhism, especially Christians. One trap is they see it as an excuse for being pluralist, as an excuse for kind of combining all religions. They all lead to the same path. And the second trap, I think, is to think that there's nothing from Buddhism that we can learn from.
Right.
And that second trap, I mean,
Dominus. Well, it's out of Vatican II, where it says there are. Rays of truth in
right.
all religions.
And, you know, if you look at the document, Dominus Jesus, it says, we can learn from other religions. And people often quote that, click. But the next stage, the next part of the same passage is, but the church is under threat of a relativism that threatens the church to become pluralist. So you can't quote that out of context. Or syncretist. So the reality is things like mindfulness and certain Buddhist practices, although they might seem benign, they're completely different. It's when you think about Christian prayer and Buddhist meditation, they're both maps to different cities. And to say that you can use a map to LA and a map to New York and get to the same place is not sensical. And I think Buddhists understand that more than many Westerners do.
Right. And that's where the idea of double belonging comes in.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you have books like, Were It Not for Buddhism, I Would Not Be a Christian. You have an old book called Zen Catholicism.
Right, I remember that.
You have some of Thomas Merton's writings, especially his Asian journals. And those texts.
Was Merton still a Catholic when he died?
This is a really good question. You know. I mean, this is the million-dollar question. He was heading home to his monastery, and of course he was electrocuted in his bathtub.
Right.
But before that, in his journals, he's writing about, I had a dream that I was a monk
right.
in
You're
monk's
talking
robes,
about it in the book. Right. Yeah.
And he thought that Buddhist mysticism can complement Catholic mysticism, and even. I think one of his arguments was that we had lost it in the church, and that Buddhism should be function as a kind of supplement to what Catholicism had lost.
Right. Now, the format you decided to use in this book is like a Q&A.
Right.
Why'd you decide to use that format?
Well, largely, you know, I teach a course every few years on the history of Buddhism in my class, and as a very devout believing Catholic, I call myself very much a catechism Catholic, not a cafeteria Catholic. My students will frequently ask me, you know, Professor Clark, how is it that you can teach Buddhism and still be a Christian, still be a Catholic? How do you reconcile those two things? And
you can ask that at some teachers at Catholic universities.
No, mind you, this is true, but we won't name anyone. So at the end of the day, I ask my students to compile questions that you think are really significant after the course. And these are fundamentally questions that emerged from my students. Questions like, is the Buddha a god? Or does Buddhism, can you say there's a theology in Buddhism?
Well, that was the point you pick up, the idea that there seems to be this denial that it is or it isn't a theology.
There is no theology in Buddhism,
right.
And I don't know a Buddhist who would argue there is a theology. In fact, the Dalai Lama, D.T. Suzuki, who was a great critic of Buddhism, Thich Nhat Hanh, even the ones who were sort of on board with Christianity as a good ethical system, all of the great Buddhist thinkers agree there's no theology in Buddhism, there's no God. At best, Buddhism is agnostic, because the question about whether or not there is a God is unimportant to Buddhism. I mean, if we think about what's the difference between Buddhism and Christianity in terms of its rules or its beliefs, one has a point, Christianity has a point, a purpose, let's just say it has a purpose, but Buddhism has an aim, and there's a very huge distinction between an aim and a purpose. An aim is to be enlightened, a purpose is we're created by God, and God is that crucial, pivotal difference.
We say Jesus identified himself as God and left the church and divine revelation to guide us to salvation. The Buddha identified himself neither as a God nor as a man per se and told his followers to work out their salvation on their own. So it's like a works righteousness thing going on there?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the very complicated things to try and express in a very short book like this is what does it mean to live and die, right? So in Buddhism, you obviously have this idea of reincarnation and this idea of karma. So people in America think that you have good karma or bad karma. You know, good karma has a good
result. My karma ran over your dogma. You used to see bumper sticker that was out there.
The reality is Buddhism doesn't view karma in that way. Karma is like an elevator. You know, the whole idea is enlightenment, extinction. Mm-hmm. So when you do things with good karma, you go up or you go down. The Buddha was very insistent that he's not a god, he's not a deity, he's not a diva, and that when he died, he was gone. He was gone from this reality. So in Buddhism, they have what they call the kind of the Buddha body, the body of his the body of his person, and then the Dharma body, the body of his teaching, and that's all that lasts.
Is that what the Dharma?
The Dharma is his teaching. So after he dies.
I remember Jethro Tull had Dharma for One. That I remember that song.
Right.
That was how I knew it.
Right, right. Well, the last thing he says is you work out on your salvation on your own.
Right.
That is, it's up to you now. I'm not part of this process.
You talk about the fact that most people relate to like Siddhartha, that story, and it kind of relate to that as Buddha.
But
if he came from multiple reincarnations, did he stop reincarnating at some point?
So, I mean, to understand the aim of Buddhism is crucial. The aim is nirvana or nibbana. And
what is that? Nothing?
What that is?
Emptiness?
Well, when Buddha was asked, is nirvana something or nothing? He said, I won't answer. Mm-hmm. Because he refused to answer that. Mm-hmm. It's extinction. The word means extinction.
So if you extinguish yourself, how would you know you were ever extinguished?
Right. So one of the things that the Buddha classically criticizes is the whole point of Buddhism is to relieve ourselves from suffering. Mm-hmm. And how do we do that? The Buddha says
because all suffering is bad.
All suffering is bad. But that's the opposite of Christianity.
Right.
I mean, suffering can associate with us with Christ mm-hmm. and has very salutary, a very salutary result. Mm-hmm. So from the point of view of Buddhism, then desire is the cause of suffering. So we have to remove desire from our consciousness and our life. So the very desire to exist mm-hmm. is what keeps us in this state of suffering. So rebirth is an optimistic name for re-death. Mm-hmm. So the ideal is to achieve enlightenment, which is nirvana, which is moksha, a liberation from suffering that is a liberation from the very self. So I can't get around the fact that for me, mm-hmm. nirvana is nothingness. Mm-hmm.
Well, let me ask you, one of the questions early on, you say, the Four Noble Truths, what are they?
So the Buddha sits under a tree, he goes through these watches of the night, and he realizes two things that are the kernel of Buddhism. Mm-hmm. The first is the Four Noble Truths, and the second is the lack of self. The second one is more complicated. The Four Noble Truths are life is suffering. The second is the cause of suffering is desire. The third is to get rid of suffering, we have to get rid of our desires. And the fourth is to pursue these eightfold paths. And one of them is actually mindfulness, forms of meditation, forms of moral behavior. So the Four Noble Truths and the doctrine of the lack of self, that's really what all Buddhists mm-hmm. can agree upon.
Mm-hmm. You say here, Buddhism imagines reality to be the cause of itself, with no God beyond it as a transcendent creator.
I think of Buddhism as, it's like a cobweb, and it's the web that has no weaver. It just mm-hmm. is. Thomas Aquinas said, creatio ex nihilo. So God created from nothing, ex nihilo nihil fit, mm-hmm. right? So from nothing, nothing comes. Buddhism holds that whatever we see as reality has always existed and always will exist. So there is no creation, mm-hmm. so to speak, no God. It talks about how you have this system of reincarnation and liberation, but what I think the fatal sort of Achilles heel of Buddhism is, so who made the system? Where does this system come from? The system of reincarnation, the system of liberation from suffering, where does that come from?
Hinduism?
Well, and Buddhism emerges from Hinduism,
right.
But at least Hinduism believes that there's some kind of great oneness mm-hmm. and that Hinduism believes that the soul is eternal. Mm-hmm. From Christianity, we have one life and an eternal soul.
Right.
In Buddhism, you could have zillions and trillions of lives and then your soul goes away. It's mm-hmm. the flip opposite.
You say here, I thought this was interesting, you got Peter Kraft. To be precise, God did not make humanity in his image to be, as Buddhism attempts to do, erased. Indirectly addressing this point, you say, Peter Kraft in his book, Making Sense Out of Suffering, says, I'm not a Buddhist, I cannot help viewing nirvana, erasure, as spiritual euthanasia. I help viewing it as that, killing the patient, the self-I, the ego, to cure the disease, egotism, selfishness. Buddhism eliminates the I that hates and suffers, yet, but there is also the I that loves. Buddhism seems to be simply unaware of the possibility of unselfish love, unselfish will, unselfish passion, unselfish self.
Peter Kraft hits it precisely right on the head of the nail there. I think that's one of the most lovely, he's very good at these short, these short sort of précis, these short consolidated statements. That's absolutely perfect. And I think too, one thing that Buddhism will never have, and that is, if we were created by a God and we were created imago Dei, that you and I were made in God's image, that somehow makes us far more important than something that needs to be eliminated. And being in God's image, we are sub-creators, mm-hmm. we are people who feel passion and love, and those are the things that make us mm-hmm. in God's image, good in God's image. I mean, you think about, everything is bad from a Buddhist point of view at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. All karma is bad karma because it traps us in suffering. Creation is bad, or not creation, they wouldn't think of it as creation, but this reality is bad. Open the Bible and read Genesis. How many times does God say, and it was good? Right. And at the very end of the first chapter of Genesis, as if to say, not only good, it's very good, mm-hmm. right? You go to Romans 8 and you see suddenly we are enlivened by the Spirit. I mean, mm-hmm. we are good beings. Sacred Scripture is full of the goodness of creation, the goodness of God's creation and us in imago Dei.
You have a quote here from Ratzinger, 99. It's reported remark that Buddhism is an autoerotic spirituality that seeks transcendence without imposing concrete religious obligations. This is the other part I wanted. He also reportedly noted Buddhism would replace Marxism as the church's biggest foe by the year 2000. You think that's still true? It seems like Marxism's back pretty big.
Now, I don't want to contradict Cardinal Ratzinger. That's something I would never want to do.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to push on this
point. No, there. But I mean, I have to say, I think that certainly Buddhism is a challenge to Christianity because it, as it is manifest in the United States. But I think the communism, I'm a scholar of China, I think the communism at this moment is a greater threat to the church. Absolutely. But when he talks about
under
it being...
Under the mask of socialism?
Oh, under the... Well, socialism with Chinese characteristics, which means despotic totalitarianism.
So is there such a thing as Zen Catholicism?
No. No, that's not a possibility. Zen would deny the reality of Catholicism. Zen would deny the reality of a creator or a god or a self. Zen is the opposite of what we would hold. I mean, Chinese emperors used to have Confucians and Buddhists debate one another. Mm-hmm. And the Buddhists' argument was always, there is nothing here, nothing exists. Everything is a delusion and an illusion. And the Confucians would always answer, well, goodness, you're not qualified to talk about reality because you don't even believe in it. Right? So this is this interesting circular argument that one finds in Buddhism. So there can't be Zen Catholicism. And then there's this claim that Zen is not a religion. That's a complicated statement, but it absolutely holds positions that are contrary to the Catholic faith.
So, Thomas Keating, who was he?
Thomas Keating, Trappist, if Thomas Merton was very interested in, if Merton was interested in Buddhism and Buddhist mysticism, Keating was very interested in a kind of Indian meditation, transcendental meditation, which is another thing. Most Buddhists think that transcendental meditation isn't a real legitimate form of meditation. So Keating was one of those other people who promoted a kind of fusion between Catholicism.
Is that where centering prayer comes into?
Very much, very much. And centering prayer, I know psychology professors who, some of them think that centering prayer is the greatest thing in the world, and others think it's the fastest avenue to certain types of psychological problems. Okay. So,
because you hear about that
you hear about that all the time.
Well, you talk about the idea with some of these things of some of these retreats centers that they go with things that are popular, I think because they're popular. I guess my question was, why are they so popular?
In the secular world, I mean, I've taught in two different university contexts, one at two state universities and the other at a Christian university. In state universities, there's less intellectual freedom than any place else. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is you really just can't talk about religion, especially Christianity, in a secular context, in a state context. So I just think we live as Christians in a very secularized environment where we feel safer talking about Buddhism or centering prayer. But why don't we try Lectio Divina? Mm-hmm. Lovely. Why don't we try the Jesus Prayer? I mean, I'm a Ruthenian Byzantine Rite Catholic. Mm-hmm. The Jesus Prayer is incredibly effective in immersing oneself in Christ and the message of His mercy. So it's just, I think it's become popular because it's more accepted.
Right. You talk about the idea that they tend to emphasize personal intention rather than performance.
Buddhists. Right. Ratzinger talks about it being autoerotic. Mm. I think in its true sense, what that means is it's self-focused. Mm. So the idea then is that I achieve my own enlightenment. And not only do I achieve my own enlightenment, but even in terms of karma and doing good actions, at the end of the day, those good actions are for my own liberation. So it is incredibly internal in that sense. And the whole, you know, as a young boy, I was always taught, we're the hands and feet of Christ. Go out and be the hands and feet of Christ to the world.
The parable of the talents. You don't bury it and come back and give what you get. Christian prayer seeks a relational encounter with God. God and man are not the same. One does not seek to find God within in Christian prayer, but rather to communicate with God the Creator, who is wholly other.
Yeah, that's precisely, that encapsulates the whole book.
Right, okay. Yeah. Well, happy we did that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for writing the book. Our author, Anthony E. Clark, PhD, Catholicism and Buddhism, The Contrasting Lives and Teachings of Jesus and Buddha. Quite interesting. Published by Cascade, available through our religious catalog. I'm Doug Heck. This has been EWTN's Bookmark. We'll see you next time. Thanks.